You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Kate Murphy. I work for Source Economic Development Fund in the Economic Advancement Program. We're going to have a few introductory remarks from my boss, Sean Hinton, from Youth Exchange, from Human Rights Initiative. I think this has been a really exciting brown bag to plan, where we had almost three programs together working on it. So it's a really exciting time for us. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sean.
Great, thank you. Chris Stone often says that the work that we do is all about people. You know, it's all about finding extraordinary people doing, you know, doing things in a new way or doing something innovative. And I've had the chance to travel with him to a few countries and, you know, looking at this and identifying and sort of feeling out where we're going to work. And I haven't met anybody that I have got as excited about the potential of working with as Rich in the last few years. I was really... Kate said, you've got to meet this guy. And I said, okay, I'm busy flying around. She said, no, you've got to meet this guy. And I really have been inspired by and challenged by a lot of the conversations that I've had the opportunity to have with Rich. So not to talk about this as a big meta macro subject, or not to sort of explain why Economic Advancement cares deeply about this, because we do, and it is important, and I'll leave that to Kate and others to talk about. But I'm just thrilled that Rich is here, and this is the beginning of what will be a very fruitful collaboration, I think, with somebody who I find, you know, really inspiring and challenging, as I say. So it's a great pleasure to have you here, Rich, and we're thrilled to be collaborating with other programs in creating this opportunity to talk.
Thank you. So just to follow up on that, thanks so much for coming. Thanks, Kate, for organizing this. Youth Exchange, we're really excited to also be kind of collaborating on this project. We have Alex here as well from Youth Exchange, and Raquel, I believe, is on the line. And so just to give a brief background for those who aren't familiar with Youth Exchange, so we're an internal support unit, or an internal campaign, what we like to call ourselves. And we work with all the programs and foundations of Open Society. As we put on the youth lens or the youth glasses, as they're looking at planning for engaging with and reflecting on youth activists as part of their broader strategies, and really one of the reasons why we're so interested in this discussion and this topic is because I think, as everyone here knows, that young people is not a homogeneous group, and we really like to ask, when we're working with youth activists across the network, whose voices are at the table and whose aren't. And one of the topics that comes up often is when working with colleagues, we speak about intersectionality of young people who are excluded over multiple layers, including youth with disabilities, LGBTQI youth, youth on the move, Roma youth. So I think throughout the network there's a lot of questions being asked over, you know, what young voices are at the table and what aren't. And so we're super excited to be joining this discussion, to learning from all of you. So thanks for having us, Kate, and I think I'll pass it over to Kimberly.
Okay. Great, thank you. I heard about Rich's work, I think, from Kate for a couple of years, actually. So I'm really glad that you're able to join us and finally meet you. I work with the Human Rights Initiative at the Open Society Foundations, and I specifically work with the disability rights teams. And we, our work, most of our grant making and our programmatic work, it has some link to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. Why employment is important is that it's actually an article of that convention, Article 27 on Work and Employment, which says that states' parties recognize the rights of persons with disabilities to work on an equal basis with others, and then it goes on and on and on. but we really promote work that that focuses on implementing the different articles of the convention. And then also something new that has come up, some of you might be familiar about Agenda 2030, which is an agreement between the UN and governments to end poverty, reduce poverty, bring equality. The Sustainable Development Goals are part of that, and they replace and build on the former MDGs, Millennium Development Goals. And I think the link to Rich here and his presentation about the economic value of the disability market is really goal number 8, which is on employment. And that includes things like the realization of reasonable accommodation in the workplace, more mainstream opportunities promote productive employment of persons with disabilities. And one other thing that I think he might find or might be a link to his presentation is the access to bank loans and microfinance. So I'll leave it there.
And so I get the honor of introducing Rich. So Rich and I first met when I read about him on the internet, and I did what I do in most situations, which I wrote to him on LinkedIn and asked if I could in any way get in front of him, and he graciously agreed. And for me, I think I am a person with a disability, and like most people with disabilities, we struggle with our identity, our role in society, and where we belong and how we belong. And I was blown away by Rich's work, and I think most of you will also be blown away by Rich's work, how he's redefining the market. I also think that you'll probably be turned on your head a little bit. I think Rich's approach, we work in the land of conventions and policies and regulation. And I think that what you'll hear will likely challenge that. And it's been a great honor in my life that Rich replied to my LinkedIn message. But I couldn't think of someone that I could be more excited to have here having this conversation with us. Rich spent the bulk of his career as a prop trader with B of A Merrill Lynch, working in the markets, trading on securities. In 2008 or in 2006, he went on to found a group called Lime Connect, which just celebrated 10 years of work and which is one of the leading disability nonprofit organizations working to place high-performing individuals with disabilities into major corporations. Simultaneous to that, Rich also went on to begin his work in developing indices that invest in companies that tie into the disability market. And Rich will be able to explain this to you much better than I can. But as an investor and as someone who tracks the markets, Rich's products have outperformed the S&P. And so you have to ask yourself, what is he doing? How is he doing it? And why is it that every person with a disability wants to be a part of it and be empowered with it? So with that, I'll stop talking and turn it over to Rich. But thank you so much for being here today. And Rich will give his slides, and then we'll kind of start with questions from the group, and Zach and I have some to kick it off. But with that, I'll figure out how to get your slides back up on the deck.
Well, great, Kate, thank you for that introduction. Now I try to live up to it, right? So here we go. As we go through this, because we're such a small group, please, if you have a question, if you want to dive deeper on something, just throw something at me, we'll do that. This is not meant to be a lecture, meant to be a conversation. So I will provoke you, I will pull you to a keyhole if I do my job well, and we can discuss all of that good stuff. Good? Okay. So before we go on to the first slide, this talk is titled Translating Different into Value. So when we started this effort, we were focused 100% on disability. And what we learned by doing our research and doing our conversations is there was a commonality in disability amongst many other groups, that there were certain things and certain characteristics that made them different from the norm. That was common in all of these groups. So we started to play around with that. We started to figure out, okay, what are the variables that actually drive value based on the different characteristics. And then we went in strategic planning session one day, and the leader of the group was promoting us. And we were spending an hour trying to figure out what the hell we did and trying to articulate that. And this got quite heated. And the facilitator looked at me and said, "Rich, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, we translate different into value." And that's where this was born. Simple, to the point, talking about difference as something that's valued by society, as opposed to traditionally shunned. So we're doing something that people with disabilities are starting to do, embracing that identity and turning what was once a disadvantage into an incredibly powerful advantage. Great. Any questions on that? Great. Let's go. So the talk started one day with a simple question. What would disability look like if it was a market? Rather than being a social cause, rather than being something good to do, what would this look like if we put the traditional characteristics of a market around it? I started to crunch those numbers and do what a good trader does and figure out, is there something there? And when I found stunned, when I started to look at this the way we typically look at trading, putting numbers around government figures, I calculated 1.3 billion people. And I couldn't make that jive with what was out there, because the UN was claiming 600 million. And I don't like to be wrong by a factor of two. It's not something I generally do. So I tried to break it. I threw everything I could trying to break this number, and I couldn't break it. So we started to put income data around that, we started to put traditional demographic data around it. And we figured out that this was the largest emerging market in the world. If you looked at things outside of geography, if you looked at things outside of the traditional way that we define markets, this was a huge bulge bracket marketplace. If I said the word disability to you, what do you think of? Don't think too hard.
Usually physical.
Right.
Physical.
What else? So typically people think the blue wheelchair, the white cane, and the hearing aid makes up less than 15% of this marketplace. I remember we were at an event with Lime, our first event in Toronto. One of the senior VPs was about something, came over to me quite shyly and whispered in my ear, "Which, I only see two wheelchairs in the room. How do we know all these guys have disabilities?" My answer was, "Do you care? You're looking for great talent." And so the mindset of this is small isn't backed up by the statistical analysis. Right? Then you say you don't have that, friends and family. So we said that every person with a disability has 1.85 people directly tied to them. Don't ask me how we come up with 1.85. It will bore the hell out of you. But when you add those two numbers together, you get 53% of the population. Think about that. 53% of the population, the second largest market in the world behind women. Not what you would assume disability is, right? Then we take another step. The U.S. Census says that those above the age 65 have at least one disability. baby boomers, the largest demographic in income-wise in human history, are now starting to reach the age 65. They're the wealthiest cohort ever in human history. And they will not be going to Florida like our parents to wait to die. They will be active consumers right up until the end. So as they age into disability, their consumer identities will be maintained. And brands and governments and those institutions that we interact with on a daily basis have to adjust to that reality. There is no choice. This is the generation that created the teenager, that created the yuppie, that created the midlife crisis, and they're going to redefine what we think retirement is. So there's a multitude of large macro demographic forces pushing this forward. That's where most people stop. The typical speech you hear in this space is all about this first slide. Then they walk away, everybody goes back to their day jobs, feeling good about themselves that they think they understand them. What we do is we then take the next step. How do you cause institutions to want to change? It's not theoretical, right? You've got these large, complex institutions full of human beings with their own agendas, their own mindsets, kids to feed, pools to pay for, agendas that are wholly unrelated to what either. So we have to figure out the connection between the macro and the micro. And what's missing today is the micro. Most people understand the macro, some better than others. Very few understand the micro. So we spent the past 8 years developing the micro. What I'm going to show you today is a little bit of that. Next slide, please. So any good market needs to be segmented. It's what we do by nature in business. Every market has its segmentation. We look at this a little differently. So disability, it starts with disability. And as you've all articulated, most people think of the visible disabilities, the wheelchairs, the white canes, and the hearing aids. That represents about 29% of the marketplace. This is all U.S. Census data. Non-visible represents the bulk of the opportunity. Most institutions don't know they exist, and if they do, they don't know how to reach out to them. They don't know how to connect with them. Those two statements are incredibly complex, even though it took about 3 seconds to say. Right? There's a lot built into those 3 seconds in order to change it. Then, as I told you, those folks have money to spend. You've heard about this space as a poor, destitute space. And some parts of it absolutely are. But the bulk of this population has disposable income, has a consumer identity that may or may not be tied to disability. In the US, they control about $650 billion in annual disposable income. The opposite of the charity message that you've heard for the last 40 years. There are ways to harness that power to cause institutions to want to change, as opposed to simply beating them over the head with regulation, which is the approach that we've taken for the last 30 years. And I can speak to this. I've just been named the chairman of the Regulatory Board for Disability in Ontario. I walked into the job interview, the first thing I said, I don't believe in regulation. I thought they would say, thank you, there's the door. But they instead gave me the job. So even government is starting to realize, hey, this isn't working. Right? We need to find a new approach to that. The fact that many of these folks control about $3.9 trillion in disposable income in the U.S. Globally, they control about $8.1 trillion across the world, excluding Asia and Africa, mainly because I have no idea how to measure Asia and Africa. So the $8 trillion is a floor, not a ceiling. We then take a final step. We don't advocate for designing products and experiences for people with disabilities. We advocate learning from people with disabilities to improve the core experience for everyone. Why do we do that? Because when that gets done, the needs of people with disabilities get met, and the returns on investment go way up for companies. Because Ford will never sell an F-150 disability version. Because nobody would buy the damn thing. Right? But if they could figure out how to make it easier for somebody with very little arm strength to drive the F-150, they just made that product better for everybody. It's a process we call lead user innovation.
What is it called?
Lead user innovation. Rather than studying the median, you study the tails. And you take from the extremes to bring it to the core. Most research today does the exact opposite. When they take from the median, from the one standard deviation around the median, and they try to learn from that. Well, okay, you're not going to learn much there. It's pretty easy to understand. If you want innovation, you've got to go seek it out from the fringes. And people with disabilities are naturally users because they do things very differently than the norm. Any questions on this? I won't bite. Okay.
Well, I want to come back to the regulation thing, but you'll get there.
Yeah. So, what does this look like from a company perspective? People with disabilities don't need to change. They know what they're doing. They've been doing it for years. They understand the situation. The change has to happen at the institutional level. So why do companies exist? We call it the dual mandate. They exist to attract customers and talent and to perform for their shareholders. Pretty simple, that's the reason why a for-profit company exists. You could argue that's the reason why a not-for-profit company exists. We just change the definition of profit. Right? You could even argue that's why government exists. Did change the measurement of performance. So we use this dual mandate to drive everything we do. How do you leverage disability, non-traditional markets, women, culture, gay, lesbian, to do those two things? And when you do that, when you put it into that context, you start to leverage demand, as opposed to pushing a string up a hill. People now want to pull that string up a hill. They want to change because they now understand it's in their best interest. Now, there's always going to be leaders. There's always going to be followers. this is not a light switch that you turn on and off. This is a process that we're now almost 8 years into. So this is a slow, glacial pace of change until it's not. Right? We're starting to have conversations now with investors. Large pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, who are realizing that they can use their dollars, their investable dollars, and their dollars investors to change corporate behavior. California Teachers, a month and a half ago, invested about $500 million in an index focused on women, whose methodology is far inferior to ours. So the demand is there. Now we need to focus that demand on what actually causes change. Any questions on that mandate? The idea is, if you treat people with disabilities as valued customers and valued employees, you empower them economically, you put cash in their jeans, you change self-worth and identity, because a job and consumer identity are core to what we are as human beings, whether we like it or not. And you start to move the needle. What you see up on that slide on the right is the top 100 companies in the U.S. for disability against the S&P 500. And that's outperformed over the last 4 years about 200 basis points a year with the same risk of the market. For those of you who are financially inclined or financial geek like I am, that's the holy grail. That's what you're always looking to find. Yeah.
So in terms of measuring those companies, the ones that are targeting and including this both on the employee and customer side,
yeah.
I'm just curious how you measure, because I don't know how easy it is to either measure the employee, since that would be a voluntary, probably.
We'll get there in about 5 minutes.
And then the customer, I'm not sure how you then show that you're targeting.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We'll get there in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Next slide, please. So this is the first answer to your question. What do we actually measure? How do we assess activity? We don't measure programs. We don't measure policy. We measure transactions. So a company is basically a collection of, depending on the size, millions or billions or thousands or hundreds of transactions. Sales to customers, purchases from vendors, hiring of people, firing of people. Everything we do as an organization generates a transaction. Transactions are observable, they're measurable. You can actually reach out and touch most of them. Whether they're products, services, people, whatever you, there's something to measure there. The increase, the decrease in volume, the increase, the decrease in size, and we can assess movement based on those factors. So we only measure things that do one of two things: lead to higher revenue or lead to reduced cost. Why? Because those two things drive value for shareholders. So the important factor here isn't the social activity. It's the activity in the social field that drives revenue up or cost down. Why do we do this? Because that's what senior management and investors care about. And that's what will drive these organizations to change behavior. Any questions on that?
Better hires. Can you talk about better hires? You're going to break these down because of that. I don't see how that's a cost.
A little bit. I'll give you an example. Fast food industries, right? They typically hire young people. The turnover is around 120% for a typical fast food restaurant. There's an example in Canada of an owner of 12 franchises at Tim Hortons. Roughly half of his staff has disability. His turnover is 44%. The average cost of him hiring new employees is about $5,000. So by cutting his turnover by two-thirds, he cuts his cost. Now, there are multiple examples as you move up the value chain, but that's a concrete example of cutting costs.
So better hires drives lower turnover, is
yep.
it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it also drives value.
Yeah, I can see how it could be revenue or something
like that. Okay. Right. Any other questions on that? Excellent.
On reduced complexity, do you want to touch on the Walgreens example maybe?
Yeah, we could do that now. So Walgreens, about 10 years ago, one of their senior vice presidents had a child with Down syndrome. And he wanted, I'm sorry, autism. And he wanted to, he came to this realization, what am I going to do with this kid when he is 22? When he goes out into the workforce, right? I mean, is his life going to be over when he ends in school? So he started to look at ways that he could integrate people with disabilities into his workforce. So he ran distribution for Walgreens. So he ran, I think, 16 distribution centers. And he decided he was going to hire half of the staff to be people with disabilities. And what he discovered was, 3 years later, the cost of the centers that did this was 20% lower than the cost of the centers that didn't do it. Why? Well, they figured out that because of disability, people had to remove complexity from their jobs. So if you had a line that was 200 feet long, and you had a guy with cerebral palsy working it, they couldn't walk very well, you condensed that line into 12 feet. Or 2 feet. You got cost and complexity out of that line. You didn't have to power that line anymore. There was less mistakes because it was simpler. And all of these things added up to about 20%. And this was consistent. Walgreens did it, P&G did it, Home Depot did it. And they all saw the same kind of productivity. So, two results happened. Socially, a bunch of people with disabilities got jobs. Yay. But profitability-wise, the company saved was $38 million a year directly to their bottom line. Now, for Walgreens, $38 million is not a lot of money. They make $40 billion in revenue every year. So their real benefit should be on the customer side. But it made for a great story. Right? Any questions? Excellent. Next slide. So here's the model. Here's how we actually do it. And this isn't the total model, but it'll give you an idea of what we look at. So we break the world down into three primary buckets. Customer, talent, and operations. For most companies, customer is the biggest value driver. So if you vent a retail customer, like a retailer or a bank or a CPG company, and you can drive your revenue up by 2 to 3% with this, the financial win is enormous. Right? Most of the talk in this space has been around talent. Companies don't exist to hire people. They hire people because they are factor production. We've been coming at this, telling companies, hire, 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 without making the case of why. Why should I care about disability? Well, you care because if you get it right on the customer side, you will drive value up. Now, if you're a gold miner, you probably shouldn't be advertising rights to people with disabilities. But the natural engineer may have a disability. So we overweight talent in that case. So depending on what the company does, these weightings change. We then break down these buckets into 30 factors. Things like customer experience in retail, customer experience online, messaging, product development, all of the things that you typically see in a customer relationship. On the talent side, we do the same thing. Number of hires, size and scope of the pipeline, messaging the candidates, how you do relative to your regulatory regime. See, we don't totally ignore regulation. So, once all of these factors are considered and they're actually measured, we actually go out and play secret shopper. I've applied to more jobs than I care to tell you about. I have a list of aliases that are 35 lines.
That means you've failed to be hired by more people as well. That's quite an accomplishment.
So we're testing how companies actually act. We don't care what their policy is. We don't care what their programs are. We care about what they're actually doing in the marketplace. I'll give you a good story. I got a call one day from the chief diversity officer of a large global payment company. And she spent about 20 minutes berating me because we don't include her company in our index. And she told me she just spent $3 million on this wonderful legal policy for hiring people with disabilities and serving them as customers. She said, that's exactly what you measure, isn't it? And after she started, I asked her a very simple question. I said, can your customers see that? And the line was silent. And she said, well, if I invite them into my office, they'll see the 30 points. And I said, look, I could argue that you just destroyed $3 million of shareholder value. Because what you did didn't actually impact your customers or your prospective employees. And it's one of the things that we routinely pound into our prospects, our clients, and anyone that we talk to. This is not about accommodation. This is about attraction. This is about going out and reaching people, bringing them in. You don't do that with policy, unless you're a law firm. Maybe a law firm might attract people with their actual policy. But for most companies, it's a brand approach. It's an approach to making yourself attractive so people will come to you. So you can go out and pull them in. That's the essence of what we're preaching. But it's not enough to preach that. We have to hold people accountable for their activity. And that's what this model is intended to do. Any questions?
I think you kind of answered it in part, but I was wondering if there's any kind of trends or correlations you saw between which companies talked about policy and kind of the returns there, or the ones that acted, or was there a mix, or what was like kind of the breakdown of those companies that stumbled upon this maybe by accident, or ones that were very deliberate in doing this?
So we've done this now. This will be our sixth cycle of research this year. We have 225,000 data points in our database now. So last year we did a regression analysis of those data points versus monthly stock returns. Okay? And what we found was activity on the customer side had a higher correlation to stock returns than anywhere else in the model. In fact, some of the talent pieces actually correlated negatively with returns. So the messaging on the talent side was really not a driver of value. Right. But product development, customer experience, I'm a stock trader by trade. When I see a correlation of 20, I throw a party. Right. In the real world, you don't look for 90 correlations. You look for indications of linkages that would absolutely fall apart at any Ivy League institution, but in the real world, they tell you what's really going on, right? So we get excited when we see these correlations in spots that we didn't expect to see. So it's really on those customer-driven factors that are pushing companies to act more, specifically in technology. Google, Microsoft, IBM, Apple, IBM less than the other three because their business model was a bit different. But those three large tech companies that face end consumers, the real value drivers are in these product cycles and in these customer experiences. When Microsoft has now put disability at the core of their strategy going forward, Google has done the same, right? So these large tech companies have figured this out, and they're starting to pull it out in a meaningful way.
Yeah. First of all, thank you. I've never thought of, well, I don't often think about markets, and certainly not in this light, so it's been fascinating so far. One of the things I was really interested was your analysis of the sort of monetary value of folks living with disability, both in Canada and the US, and I imagine some of that monetary value also is in the form of shares. And so taking that idea with the idea that these changes have really been pushed by the customers, I wonder if shareholder activism has had any role in pushing some of the companies you mentioned or others into sort of thinking about things in this way.
Not yet. We're not there yet, but in Canada, the US specifically, there are two 401k type programs for people with disabilities and their families. In Canada, the potential is about $40 billion. In the U.S., the potential is about $2 trillion over the next 5 years. So as these programs grow, and people with disabilities start to have more power as investors, and that gets consolidated into providers of vehicles that they can invest in, that's when the activism starts to get real. So in 5 years, there's going to be more people with disabilities on boards of directors. There's going to be more people with disabilities driving investor demand. All of these things will happen. It's just a question of just letting time and pounding the table take its course, right? And this is a well-worn path. Sustainability's been doing this now for almost a decade. Not incredibly well, but it's been doing it. And this will take that course as well. Yeah.
Just a question about the different ways that this can manifest. So you've given examples so far of like Walgreens, where their savings and their innovation came on the back end, yeah, not the consumer side. And then you just gave the example of Google and Apple and some of the other tech companies who are creating products on the customer-facing end that are appealing to people with disabilities.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if, you know, there's many different facets to this question and the presentation that you're giving, but is it dependent on the industry or the product, or are there correlations you've found or trends where one side is better or more important, or where one leads to the other? You know, like should companies first focus on, you know, creating products for and you know, focusing on that market? Should they, you know, work on hiring people and having policies, whether they come before the hiring or after the hiring, that go along with hiring people with disabilities, and then that will drive things internally and that will lead to the better customer outcomes? How does it sort of fit together?
I'll give you a very NBA answer. It depends. Every company, every culture is very different. Right? So Google tends to move quickly. Google tends to adopt things and just go. That doesn't happen at an IBM. Right? So it could come at, what typically happens is there's a champion internally that says, I have a passion for this. That approach typically fails because that champion moves. Right? And it doesn't become institutional. The Googles of the world, the Microsofts of the world, the Apples of the world, this is embedded in what they do every single day. Right? That's sustainable. That's something that you can go over time. These one-off championship efforts, much like a soccer match, you may have a team today that's fantastic. The next year, you're not going to be able to duplicate because somebody retires or somebody goes away or traded. Those tend to be unsustainable. So what we see, and this is where this is complex, is large companies that embed this in what they do are far more successful than a end-around rush by a group of champions that really have no power.
And I'm curious as to whether the SASB, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board, what you think about that, because what I've heard from them, it's a similar approach, which is to show how the social and environmental concerns or standards or indices that they've developed, if taken into account by companies, would drive shareholder value as well. And so I'm not totally familiar with all of their indices, so I'm wondering if what you think about them and if disabilities is part of that and if they're not sufficient or
I was fortunate enough to get invited to the Global Reporting Initiative's conference last May in Amsterdam. And it was my first exposure to sustainability. They've been at this now for 10 years. They got metrics coming at the wazoo over there, right? And they can measure all kinds of different things. What I was stunned by was the honesty from the stage about the level of quality of the data. I think the technical term they used many, many times was crap. I think there's a missing link in the current approach, and that missing link is a link to value for individual companies. To come up on stage and say, this drives value. Okay, prove it. Right? If you're a CEO at a large institution, you have one boss, your board. That board is fiduciarily bound by law to do what's best for the investor. So in order to make these organizations want to change at the board level, based on that fiduciary bound, you have to make this valuable. You have to have not merely a passing link to value, you have to have a fiduciary link to value. And that may sound semantical, but fiduciary, in my world, is the toughest hurdle to overcome. Right? If you're not able to meet that fiduciary hurdle, you're dead. I don't think sustainability has been able to do that yet. I think they're close, they're in the right direction. Well, whether they're close or not, I don't know. But directionally, they're correct. Right? They're moving in the right direction. They haven't got that yet. And I think that's the difference in what we're doing. We start there. We start with that fiduciary link. Because we know that that's what's going to cause behavioral change.
Yeah. You mentioned that, basically, that, if I'm understanding correctly, that product innovation, right, and consumer and customer experience innovation drives value in a way that operational and talent drivers don't. And so I'm just curious, and you also mentioned, sorry, that because it's dependent on a champion, that organizational change is harder to sustain. But for the ones which have gotten over the hurdle, that it's been institutionalized, so like a lead user innovation in an organization, an operation, once they get to that threshold, are they more likely at that point to basically just be more resilient, more profitable?
This gets easy. So I'll give you a good example. So telecom is one of the most regulated spaces in disability, right? The SEC and the CRTC have bespoke regulations for disability. They're bullshit. They don't impact corporate activity. They go through the regulatory framework within the company. The lawyers react and build all these programs and policies to say, look, we're disability friendly. One of our clients is a telco. When they hired us, they didn't put us into the regulatory bucket. They put us right into product development. So we're dealing with the senior vice president of product development as opposed to the senior vice president of regulatory. The tone of that conversation and the activity that comes out of it goes into products and services, not into policies and programs. So it's a very tactical shift away from the airy-fairy world of policy into actually changing corporate action, corporate activity, products, services, interactions with customers.
So I think when the question earlier was, going a step back then, do you see companies that adopt a sort of policy on this where the policy then results in people taking people with P&L responsibilities or product development decisions making meaningful changes?
Yeah.
Or is it actually realistically comes the other way around, which is that there's a champion, there's an individual, there's a sort of a, you know, a leader who gets an idea and sort of puts
it. It happens both ways. And so we have a rule of thumb in our research. We see a lawsuit, from the government or from an individual, we can say with almost certainty that 3 years later, that company now will be focusing on the customer relative to disability.
You see a lawsuit.
We see a lawsuit.
A lawsuit will often
trigger. The lawsuit is what made people go, oh, we have a problem.
That's interesting.
And it generally takes 3 years for them to figure out that the problem isn't regulatory. The problem is based in how they work with their customers and their employees. And it's fascinating to watch. The 3 years is pretty good in terms of a tight standard deviation about it. I think there are 255 companies in our universe that have a lawsuit that we can find. And usually it takes 3 or 4 years to get to some kind of market-facing activity.
And you would see them translate that into some sort of customer result? Or
maybe. The good ones would.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've looked at systems outside of North America, but do you find any difference in systems where fiduciary trusts don't prioritize or don't exclusively prioritize the shareholder? So stakeholder systems? And
so Europe is exactly that, right? So Europe tends to be far more reactionary to regulation. Canada also tends to historically react to regulation stronger than the U.S. The U.S. has a larger customer base, so they tend to be focused on the customer a little bit more. But we're splitting hairs here. It's not like there's an obvious trend between one or the other. But
I mean, in terms of performance.
I don't know. We haven't analyzed Europe yet. That's on the drawing board.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, between Canada and the U.S., there's a difference. And I think I have a slide up here that will show you that. But the scores are higher in the U.S. because they're reacting to market demand.
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, they tend to react to regulation.
Yeah, but the really outrageous thing you said to me last time was that you actually can track the increase in legislation resulting in a decrease in performance,
right,
on the measures you're looking for.
Yes.
That actually, far from having a positive result, actually people get distracted or reliant on compliance with those regulations, which I find it's very troubling.
I have two telco clients. One is focused on product development, serving their customers. Both value-added drivers. The other is, in the last 6 months, mapping out the accommodation process for the employee. They both spend exactly the same money, exactly the same time. One is driven by customer performance, one is driven by regulation. Which one do you think is going to outperform? The one that's doing the customer-facing activity. So it can be that stark and obvious to see how companies get this wrong. I've gotten phone calls from employees at the one focused on the market side, thanking me ridiculously for changing the mindset of the company. In 2 years, they've gone from, we can't get anything done on disability, to, now we can get anything done we want to get done. All because they started to focus on their customers. It's astonishing to me.
So I guess with that, it's 1:15, and I want to ask the group what would be, I can see everyone's smoke coming out of everyone's ears. I know it's also coming out of mine. So Rich, and we could, I don't know what would be best. Anyone who has to leave, please certainly, please do that. But if those want to stay around, we can quickly wrap up the slides.
Absolutely.
And then in private conversation, finish up the any questions people might have.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So should I?
So any questions on the model itself?
His questions will not finish. I promise you.
No, I'll hold off until.
No, go on, Robert. I'm teasing. Okay.
You said that there were some which negatively correlated with talent, or some of the talent variables negatively correlated with performance.
Yeah.
But do you have any sense of why, or?
I think it's because the activity is wrong. Also understand that the activity is so small that that negative correlation may not say much. But it may be an indicator of the culture, right? You miss the activity, the quality, the scores don't tell you the quality of activity, they just measure the activity, right? So it may be simply cultural environment, but I wouldn't assign much value to that correlation. But it also passes my smell test. Like if companies are focused on talent and talent alone, they're generally missing the boat. By the way, you don't want to see a Star Trek of Wolverines right now. It's not pretty. Right? So keep that in mind. Okay.
Next slide.
So we then take the top performers in our universe and we analyze about 1,100 companies in the US and 300 in Canada. Take the top 100 in the US, put them into an equal weighted equity vehicle. Don't ask me to explain the vehicle. We don't have the time to do that today. But needless to say, this listed on the New York Stock Exchange September 11th, 2014. This is us ringing the bell, the world's first disability-linked stock market index anywhere. We think this is a model to follow for non-traditional markets to get investors in the door. This is primarily focused on institutional investors today, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, endowments who want to drive this. My big aha moment at GRI was sustainability has figured out environment, they figured out governance, they have no clue what to do with the social side.
With the
social perspective. I actually saw people get nervous when the word social was out there. There was quite funny just reading body language, right? It was. They just don't know how to measure it. They don't know how to link it to performance. It's not that hard. It really isn't. So we use this with investors to get them focused on the market. We also use this as a reward for companies. It's one thing for me to say this. It's another thing for the CIO of CalPERS to say, hey, I just invested $500 million in the disability index. What are you doing about disability? When the CEO gets that phone call, watch the fur fly. Right? That's how institutions change. They don't react to advocates. They react to investor demand. They react to customer demand too, but that typically lags.
Are there many indices that
people could, that companies could take action, and as a result of that action, they participate in. Because most indexes, I was just thinking, most indexes are sort of, I mean, objective. They're industry, they are performance, they are, you know, they're sort of determined by factors outside of the control of the company themselves.
Yeah.
Because there aren't many, are there? What are the sort of indices where you could sort of, if you took behavior, you could self-select if?
And they're typically backward-looking.
Right,
so
yeah,
they're typically
right.
Based on activity that's a year, 2 quarters old, that you have no control. This is a forward-looking concept, right?
No, but you must be measuring history, because you're measuring existing
transactions. We're measuring existing transactions, but we're also forecasting where the transactions will lead to, right? So, companies' activities today versus a financial measurement that was based on activity at least a quarter old, right? Usually, you're planning 2 years in advance for something that happens today, right? So, a new launch by Pepsi started 2 years ago.
So if your one of the transactions you're tracking is new product development in this space, you're
right.
Saying that will result. Oh, I see. That's interesting. So that results in forward-looking,
right.
Not forward, but it's historical activity that has future financial implications.
But
I see.
It's not necessarily impactful yesterday. But it's going to be impactful once this market.
Right, but it's happened, so it's not predictive.
Exactly.
But the fact that you could self-select into it, because the point with, because I think one of the points that I found really interesting is the carrot. You know, you're saying there's something about corporate behavior.
Right.
Part of your theory of change is, you know, corporations have significant influence. The things that drive corporate behavior are carrots and sticks.
Yeah.
Regulation is a stick, fairly ineffective, possibly negatively. But there is a carrot here that would could incentivize corporates to make changes in their behavior.
Yeah.
And the carrot here is, at one level, the recognition, the participation in an index that's getting significant.
So there's two women's indexes out there today. She, which is the State Street product, and WIL, which is the Barclays product. Both use basically the same methodology on percentage of women in senior management at the board level. 30%, right? I don't know what the hell that has to do with value. It's easy to measure. You can go to an annual report, count the number of women on the board, count the number of women in the senior management. Is it above or below 30%? But what does that have to do with company value? Right? What we're trying to do is incent actual corporate behavior. How they're out there in their day-to-day activity changing what they do. Does that happen in a week? No. It takes years to do. Like Google's been at this for a decade old. It's at the core of what they do. Apple the same way. Right? So these changes tend to be glacial, but they get made and they get observed. What we're trying to focus companies on is the activity. Not the sentiment.
This is a bit of a forming thought, so I apologize if it's unclear. So, I mean, I think you've demonstrated clearly that the disability people's market is large, and those companies that cater to this perform very well. And I was wondering, and I don't know if there's a data for this, but if you've seen a correlation between kind of government legislation that impacts the disability people's market. So, I mean, even in Canada, the assisted suicide and kind of how these large government legislation impacting this market then impacts kind of the profitability of companies or the return, and kind of trying to build a case to governments that this impact in the social sector has a lagging impact on companies down the road.
You're not
going to
like the answer.
So we're talking Sean's favorite subject here. So there are various regimes in Europe, Canada, and the U.S. around hiring quotas for people with disabilities, right? In Canada, they've been around for 25 years. They're new in the U.S. about 2 years old. In Europe, they've been around for 10 years or 5 years. Anywhere between 1.4... They're also in Japan, by the way. So Japan has a target of 1.6%. The U.S. has a target of 7%. Canada has a target that I still can't figure out. And the Europe has targets ranging from 2% to 6%. Right? None of those targets have been realized. None. But what it has done is it's created a benchmark for companies to aim to. So what you get is you get policy statements that I can send you, hundreds of these things, on websites that say, we will accommodate you to the best extent that we can as required by law if you need an accommodation for disability. Really attractive statement. Yeah, I want to live there, right? So the quality of activity is terrible. And you get these companies, as a Canadian bank who spent $5 million a year for 5 years trying to hire people with disabilities, ended up hiring 12 people. That's a pretty high per-person cost hire, right? So the messaging, the benchmark of regulation is so ridiculously unrelated to what actually brings people in the door that you end up with activity that you just want. TD Bank figured out what they were doing wrong about 3 years ago. They stopped talking about regulation publicly. Focus only on the business value. They did this internally, they did this externally. Their numbers went up by 50% in 3 years. By making a simple change that cost them nothing, changing their language, right? So when you're bound by that regulatory mandate, the lawyers are your recruiters. And that ends up being a disaster. Right?
So my problem is that just because you have seen that the introduction of some of these pieces of legislation results in worse performance, doesn't result in improved performance, actually results in worse performance, whether the companies are distracted or whether they are put resources into this instead of other things or whatever it is, doesn't mean that that is always true. Doesn't mean that there isn't. But that could be the effect of the legislation that's been given. So it doesn't mean that
what we do
with the right legislation.
What we do see is the quantity of the activity under regulatory mandate is higher, but the quality of activity is lower. So there are more companies in Canada active, but the quality of activity in Canada on average is lower than the quality of activity in the U.S.
And that's not just because Canada's just the quality.
Exactly. All right,
I can't resist. It's such a terrible Canadian accent.
Was there anything about maybe not regulations tied to employment, but regulations for or legislation writ large for people with disabilities in society? So more recognition legally, nothing tied to companies or their employment, and then just kind of the kind of tying the respect that society has for just people with disabilities and improvements, or is that kind of too out there and not enough data points to kind of draw a correlation?
It's really hard to package that up, right? Because Canada's a good example. So Canada's a human rights code law for 35, 40 years, right? Disability pointed out. It's only the last couple, 5 years that Canadian society has started to have these conversations with disability in the mainstream. No legal shifts have happened. No new laws have been enacted to cause that. But there's been a remarkable shift in the brand conversation around disability. Right? Because people like me are starting to take over that identity. So in Canada and the US, you had your first laws in education in 1975. That mandated mainstream. That only really took effect in the 80s. So I'm on the front edge of that wave. If you go look at 20-somethings today who have my or other disabilities, they have totally different expectations than I had when I was 20. Right? There was no me to look up to right now. So you see a shift in people owning that identity because of regulation. There you go, Sean.
Yeah.
So it's not just that regulation is bad. No. It's how do we use it as a tool to shift society's thoughts. Not wait 40 damn years for it to evolve through generation, right? That's the real challenge here, is how do you pull those levers to encourage economic behavior change, right? There are ways to do it. The environment has done it spectacularly in the last 5 to 6 years. Solar power is the cheapest form of power in the U.S. now. You couldn't say that 5 years ago. And so there's learnings there that we can learn. Yeah.
And I would imagine that there are, when I'm trying to think about this, it's just so fascinating, right? Because it's not something that you normally think about. So thank you for stimulating this. I would think that there, on the one, and I don't know if you see all of these companies, on the one hand, they're the companies that actually cater to the disability market, right? In terms of, I was just seeing about the wheelchair that the new technology of being able to stand up on the wheelchair and having way greater accessibility. So that's a company that specifically targets, let's say, disability. Then they're the ones who might accidentally, without knowing it, their products are actually quite accessible. And then they're the ones who may not have been realizing that and need to shift some sort of behavior in order to do a better job. And so I'm wondering, do you, is that right? Is that, am I?
Take a guess at what sector scores the worst in our ratings. What sector would you think is the worst score in our ratings? Healthcare.
Yeah.
Interesting. Isn't that interesting? Healthcare score is the worst average score in average, which stuns me.
Canada and the U.S.?
Canada and the U.S. It's Canada. Well, Canada is really no healthcare companies, but,
right.
But the, of the few that there are, they score the worst in average. What? Why do you think that is? Because they're treating it as a clinical diagnosis, not a customer approach.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right? I can almost look at the homepage of a healthcare company and tell you which company has a clinical scientific focus and which company has a customer focus. And tell you that the customer focus will outperform the clinical focus every time, on average. No, the clinical focus guys, from a financial point of view, it's basically the lottery. Right? Whatever, you're looking for product to hit it big. You got 20 products out there, one's going to do well, the other 19 are going to fail. And you're looking, it's a lottery. The guys with the customer focus are building a business. And it's one of the fascinating things that I never would have expected. When I started this, people thought this was a healthcare index. And when I showed them what was in the index, they were confused because there were very few healthcare companies in there, which is fun. I enjoy making people think a little bit, right? So it's fascinating to me to see this dichotomy of companies that probably see this stuff all day, every day, and they get it so abjectly wrong. It's amazing.
So I have one question as well. I know we're going over. I'm going to go back to actually Eli's point on, or the point you were talking about on education, just because earlier today you mentioned those who are financially inclined, and I am not. So I am probably the least financially inclined person here, so I'm learning a lot. But I'll go back to another question I had, and I'm just wondering, you know, have any of these companies ever looked at an association back into education of their future employees? It seems like, you know, if we look at the developing world where there's a huge disparity in education among people with disabilities, and also in the U.S. or in the U.K., for example, I just know from my own state, but in higher institutions for people with intellectual disabilities, it's more expensive to even attend the universities in our state. It's right. Almost triple the cost. Right. And I'm just wondering, has there been any kind of pressure back on companies that have made the shift to talk about you know, that the disparity in education that's you know, not allowing their employees to have that fair competition when they're applying for the...
Excellent question. Education is something that disability actually has right in North America. If you look at graduation rates of university, high school, they tend to be higher for people with disabilities than the typical population, which is fantastic, right? One of the things that we do measure is this notion of pipeline. So are you building a pipeline so that you can have future harvest of talent, right? So Google does this. Google has scholarships. Google reaches right down into the high schools. The graduate guys are poor. Disability is part of that, right? So companies, good companies, foster and build their pipelines like it was their very... They're very, it's the core of what they do, right? It's the core of their talent strategy is to make sure you foster this pipeline. At the end of the day, does it drive value? A little bit. But it's not the ultimate driver of value. Right? So we tell our clients, yes, by all means do it, but this can't be your only strategy.
The index, do you anticipate, I mean, obviously this is very rosy sort of future to look at. I know this is not the problem today, but in theory over time, as this became standard behavior, the ability to distinguish yourself should erode over time.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it's...
Hopefully if we do our job right. I mean, when I was at Merrill Lynch, our average trade was done for 2 weeks because it got valued quickly. This is not going to be too good. So hopefully we value this. If this is valued, is this because the S&P 500?
Yeah, that's right.
We're done. We can move on to something else.
Something else. Yeah,
what's
good.
The next trade?
High class problems. Great stuff.
Well, just being conscious of time, I think it probably makes sense to wrap up. I just want to say... Thank you for coming in to speak with us, and thank you for taking my random LinkedIn message. I think that you said you enjoy making people think, and I think that all of us have a lot of thinking to do, and I think our minds have really been shaped by this conversation, and I'm sure there's many who disagree and many agree, or many who agree in parts and disagree in parts, but I think that the conversation has started, and I so appreciate you taking the time and energy to be with us.
My pleasure.
It's really something to be in your presence, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.